taping Great Biblical Personalities. Today is August 25th, and we start with Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, Sarah, Rachel, and Leah. And this is a very protected group in rabbinic literature. I say protected is because they certainly in the writings of the Rishonim, you know, whatever Avraham does, if he does something that you might think is questionable, you'll find a perush or a commentary that says that this is justifiable behavior. Right? We'll see that in Chazal. When I say Chazal, I mean Medrash Rabba, Gemaras. Right? I will not use Chazal when describing Rashi. But in the writings of the Midrashim and the Gemaras, we see that they certainly are willing to question some of the actions of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. You see a willingness to treat their actions critically if there is some lesson to be learned from it. Right? Okay. Why is it that someone like Rashi or Ibn Ezra go out of their way to try to explain all of those cases in as good a light as possible? I'll give some examples to start with. Is actually the topic of number 3 right here on your... I thought you'd have computers so you could just go online, but if it's just a few of you, I'll make up copies for the next class of this list of what we're doing. Number 3 is a book written by David Berger. It's interesting to teach here. His name is Professor David Berger. The book is called On the Morality of the Patriarchs in Jewish Polemic and Exegesis. I repeat, you have to write it down. On the Morality of the Patriarchs in Jewish Polemic and Exegesis. Exegesis means parsha, meaning Rashi. Jewish Polemic, however, you have to really explain, and that's really the thesis of his book, is that the reason why the rabbis were so intent, especially in Rashi's time, of explaining everything Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov does to be positive. Yaakov took the blessing from his brother, explained it, the flip side is that everything that someone like Esav or Lavan alone does is always negative, right? So David Berger in this work, this is again number 3 on your cover, the 29 entries here, this is one of them, number 3. 29 topics we're covering the whole semester, so this is number 3 right now. And this is a short little pamphlet, that says that Jews, I mean, let me ask you, when you're reading a story of Parshas Lech about Avraham, you're teaching your child the story about Avraham. Right? Why is it your best interest to explain this story in as good a light as possible?
Because you tell them some bad things, they might question the idea of religion. Based off of these people who did bad things, and should we really follow this? These patriarchs, should we be the role models?
Right, yeah, yes, after all. They're a role, that's the key. The role model, they are. David, we say their names every day, and we start with David, they've established our system of religion. They these are great people, right? So and especially given a particular Maimar Chazal, it's called Maaseh Avot Siman Lebanim. Have you heard of that? Maaseh Avot, the actions of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov are like blueprints, the templates for what would happen to us in the future. So it stands for us if that is true, that Sefer Bereishis is a template for the future, right? I'll give you just a quick example of this. Why do Jews do so well economically whenever given good, equal opportunity? You know that, right? Wherever Jews live, they bring prosperity. There's nothing comparable to this. Right? Go to any community where it's a Jewish neighborhood, you see phenomenal success and wealth. Everybody you know went to college. And if someone didn't, that's just a standout exception. But in some places in this country, only 30% go to high school. But everybody you know is geared for success. From your earliest day, you go to a double program. You're going to even the Jews who are not going to yeshiva, they're going to Dalton, they're going... And they're just primed. Why? Why does this happen to us? Is it the way we read Hebrew? Is it something in our DNA? Right? So the Ramban says, because Rivka vouchsafed for Yaakov a bracha of Gashmius. Yaakov was only supposed to get the bracha of Ruchnius. Right? You know the difference, right? Yaakov was only supposed to get Birkat Avraham, v'chol zarecha itoch, v'ishtecha ederetz megurecha shnatan elokim la'Avraham. Yaakov was only supposed to get the bracha of Avraham to inherit the land of Israel and to inherit spiritual things. Esav was supposed to get Tala Shamayim, Shmane Ha'oretz, Rov Dagon V'Tirosh, everything Gashmi. You with me?
Yeah.
Everything of this earth. No mention of Abraham, no mention of the land of Israel. Yitzchak very well between his two sons. Esav is a Gashmi kind of guy. He lives for the day, he puts food on the table, let me give him Gashmius. Yaakov is a Ruchni guy, he's getting Israel, he's getting the Brach of Abraham, showing one for him, one for him. And Rivka says, no, Yitzchak can make a big mistake. I was there when I was pregnant, and I said, God told me, Rav Yaakov Sa'ir. So Yitzchak said, Rivka, how many times are you going to tell me that? You told me the day it happened. I disagreed with you as far as what it meant. God purposely used ambiguous words. He didn't say, Abachor Yaakov Sa'ir. He said, Rav Yaakov Sa'ir. Greatness will make its way to the younger one. I'm giving the younger one greatness. I'm giving him Israel. I'm giving him my father's bracha. But it's not fair. I'm not going to give Gashmius to Esav. I'm not happy that my brother fell out of the family. I want both my sons to follow my path. I know their strengths. I know their weaknesses. They'll be like Yisachar and Zvulun. Esav gets the Gashmius. Yaakov gets the Ruchnius. That's my plan. And Rivka got her way, like all women in Sefer Bereishis do. When it comes to what the future is going to be. Only in Yosef's case, everything blew up because there was no Rachel. She died. If Rachel were alive, we know she would have resolved the hatred between Yosef and his brothers. The fathers are out to lunch a little bit about their sons, and the women always get their way. Hashem tells Avram, you listen to Sarah, she knows better. Rivka doesn't even come to that. She just gets her way. Right? Okay, you with me? So here's how Ramban reads this. If you believe Ma'asavot Siman Labanim, that Yaakov was vouchsafed a bracha of Gashmius, that's why we do so well. So if you read the Torah that way, I'm not saying that this is the only way to read Sefer Bereishis, but if you do read the Torah that way, like Radak, like Ramban, like Ibn Ezra, like Rashi, if you do read the Torah that way, then of course you're going to explain it as good a way as possible. Why do I want to explain what Yaakov did to be a bad sign for the future? You follow me? Alright, however you like it. Yaakov has to pay some, right? He's to flee his brother's wrath. Why don't they just send home? It should be easier to send home for a woman for Yaakov in this generation than when I sent someone up north in Parshas Chayisar. We didn't even know where he was going. He had to find out where Lavan is. Now we know Lavan. It's my mother's brother. Just send to some of his daughters and shine. Why did they have to send Yaakov? Because Yaakov was not only going up to find a wife, that's the excuse Rivka gives to Yitzchak, so he doesn't have to hear about anything about the hatred and the prophet. She doesn't ever want her husband to find out she was behind that. Right? So she has to give up a different reason why Yaakov has to leave home, which is to find a wife. Right? So Yaakov suffers somewhat. Right? He suffers tremendous ironies while he's trying to build his own family. He falls in love with a younger sister. Who does he get? Older one. Yaakov, remember you didn't believe you knew the older one? Right? Hey, I'm here. And when you went to complain to your father-in-law about why you, hey, I wanted the younger one, he gave me the older one. He said, lo yosekein bim komeinu lo se satsi'ir lifnei abachira. Which word is stressed there? In our place, we don't give the younger before the older. You hear what he's saying? Bim komeinu. Like you do in your place. I heard what you did. Word got down to me. That's why you had to leave home. Right? In our place, we go in order. Not like you do. Right? So Yaakov gets these hints. So be careful, Jews. You do so well in a land that's not yours. You succeed beyond anyone's expectation and you don't worship the gods of the place where you live. What do you think is going to happen? Think of our historical experience. It's safer, gracious. Right? We do so well in Egypt. Why do you think the Egyptians started to hate the Jews after all that we did for them? Because it looked like to the average Egyptian that Yosef used his insider information about the famine in order to despoil the Egyptians. It wasn't to them, it was Paro. Right? But Yosef looks like this Jew who comes in from the outside. They all succeed. Be careful. Comes with a price. Right? So if you read Sefer Bereishis this way, argues David Berger, then you're going to explain the narratives in as good a way as possible. Right? But is it your fault? What's the difference?
David.
As David explains, look, you know, if you're teaching your 7-year-old, you're teaching your 5-year-old the Parsha, your name is Sarah, my daughter. You know, you're named after Rivka. You know, these are names we use. You have a friend named Rachel. So good, these are heroes for us. Okay? Got it? But be careful, because that's all we'll do with number 3. Right? Let me tell you about number 2, which is my master's thesis. This is called Rabbinic Reflection on Violation of Pentateuchal Law in the Books of Joshua, Judges, and Samuel. Introductions and Conclusions. That's what you're supposed to read in it. But this work runs through over 100 places in the Vayim Rishonim where there's a clear and present violation of the Torah and how Chazal deal with those violations. Right? And it draws conclusions about the way that the main character, of course, in all of this will be David. Right? You know, David, the story of David Bacheva can be taught in a certain way in some yeshivas where the kids have to wonder, so why was he even punished? Right? Because we're afraid that the kids will say, David Chas Hashem, David, So, by the way, we just explained, without Rabbi Yitzchok and Yaakov. So, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah, what's the advantage of only explaining them in as good a light as possible? That extends to everyone. Right? Okay, so, we're going to read a passage here about David. We still have to want to get some more introductory material. This master's thesis that I wrote, it was 1985. Probably you guys weren't born yet. So the point of my thesis is to categorize. I categorized in 5 different ways the reasons and the ways that Chazal dealt with certain biblical characters. I categorized in 5 different ways. But plus, I also dealt with different geographical areas. I'm going to show you over this semester that Sfardim and Ashkenazim in the Middle Ages looked at this in a very different way. And number 3, David Berger's work goes a long way to explain this. Because Jews were arguing about these issues with Christians, but not at all with Muslims. 2 very important reasons. Christians revere our Tanakh as much as we do. So they read it, they're aware of the stories of Avraham Yitzchak and Yaakov. Muslims don't. Our Tanakh means nothing to Muslims. Some of our biblical characters, especially in Sefer Bereishis, are revered in the Quran, right? Very different stories. Avraham Yitzchak and Yaakov do appear in the Quran. Only in the Quran, it's Yitzchak who was cast out of the house for being a bad influence on Yishmael. Right? So Jews living amongst Muslims were accused of falsifying the Torah in order to fit our historical agenda, which is absurd. Dead Sea Scrolls put that ridiculous claim to rest. But Jews have been accused of that since the 8th and 9th centuries. Right? Never mind the Christian Bibles, which also predate Islam. Why would the Christians also care to have Yitzchak as the one favorite son, Ishmael Castle? Right? And even the Muslims who admit that Ishmael was cast away claim, okay, well, you were cast away also. Not by Abraham, but by Nebuchadnezzar. Now you want to come back? All right. So Jews living amongst Christians, who amazingly tended to side with Esav against Yaakov, right? Which is funny because we also call Christians Esav, right? Edom. Yeah. So when the Christians were, that's the word polemic here, Jewish polemic. A polemic is where 2 different religions are arguing about the relative meaning of text or theology or philosophy, right? So the Christians were claiming that you Jews are acting immorally, you're cheating us, you're only succeeding because of your trickery and chicanery, right? the deck is stacked against us because of your. It sounds like, you know, the way the 1% is treated. You know, you're gaming the system against us, right? Because how else could you be so successful? It could only be because you have a pact with the devil and you make you do things that we wouldn't do, etc. It's correct. It was one thing that the Christians forced the Jews to do that they wouldn't do, and that's why they forced us to do it, was to collect usury. To charge on interest. Christians wouldn't charge each other on interest, but they didn't need to loan money. So that's all the Jew could do. Hence the Merchant of Venice. Everyone knows the Jew as the money lender. Jews couldn't enter guilds. They couldn't learn crafts. They couldn't own land. So what else can you do but loan money in order to make a living? If not just to work amongst the Jewish community. But the Christians forced Jews generally to do two things. To open taverns, because Christians didn't want to sell liquor to other Christians, and to loan money. Salacious kinds of occupations, but there was nothing else for us to do. Right? For hundreds of years, in most every place in Europe. So when Jews were accused of such chicanery and illicit business behavior, and the Christians were polemicizing, that means again, you're arguing over philosophy over text, and the Christians said, see, look how Yaakov steals his brother's birthright, and then he takes his blood blessing again and by afterwards. You're behaving just like Yaakov. You're Israel, and you're behaving like the original Israel. So the Jews, when confronted with this, they tended to, you know, write in their commentaries, no, they're wrong. It's Esav dealing with deceit. When his father came to him and said, I want to give you a blessing of the birthright, he should have told him right there, Dad, you may not like this, but the birthright is not mine. He sold it a long time ago. Not for a bowl of syrup, a bowl of lentils. A bowl of lentils was what iced the deal. The deal was he sold him something of great value. When Yaakov Nosan let Esav, he had given him something else. And then the Lechem Unazid Adoshim was to, when you made a deal in ancient times, you ate something over it. Right?
What did he give him?
It doesn't do Reshfam writes, he just gave him something of value, something of momentary value. You see, to Esav, the Bechora meant something that I get after my father dies. He didn't know Chiyo Lechemus. I expect to die first. I see death every day in the field with my hunting, so I don't care about tomorrow, about what my son is going to get. I'm probably not going to have, you know, much time with that. I care about what I'm getting today. I care about the moment, right? So that's the way. So the Jews presented Esav that way because that's the way they saw the Romans and the Christians. It's interesting in our Midrashim, but this is not the topic of our course. But in our Midrashim, the way we present Esav is the way we saw the Romans. Esav who Edom. Edom is Rome. So the way we saw Roman behavior, we applied to Esav. There's a lot of theories about this, that when the rabbis wanted and the Gemara wanted to say something negative about Jesus or about the Romans in general, they couldn't outright say it. That would get them killed. Right? The Talmud was finished with Christendom, with the thumb on Judaism, worse than anything you read about in the Middle Ages. The early times, 400, 500, was awful. So a Jew to write something negative about Christianity is suicide. So what they would do is, I mean, there's theories about this. I'm not sure if it's true or not. I'm not sure if it's scholarly or not. But what they did was they would write about Bilaam, someone like that. And then with the writing about Bilaam, wink, wink, the Jews would know that we're talking about Jesus. I mean, the proof that some give is that the age that Chazal say Bilaam died is the age that Jesus dies in the New Testament. The age of 34. Could be. Alright, but everything else they said, you would see what the Midrashim say about what Bilaam did. I can't say them here. Right? So that they mean to be saying that that's what we think Jesus was doing. Right? It could be. But when Chazal said that Esav came in that day that he sold his birthright, what did he do that day? He killed a pig, sliced off its leg, and drank its blood. He stole Nimrod's coat. That was Adar Marishon's coat. And then he killed him. He interrupted a wedding and raped the bride and her mother under the bridal canopy. couple other things, but you see he's violating all the Shabbat mitzvahs b'nei Noach. In other words, we see that the Romans are not behaving like good Noachites, and that's because they learned that from Esav. Right? That's why he was tired that day. Right? So even Rashi brings a pasuk where are you tired from committing murder, so that's what made him tired. Anyway, the upshot is that you understand from source 2 and source 3, which is my thesis in David Berger's book, which is that we understand why there is this penchant to try to explain their activities in as positive a mode as possible. Right? Because they serve as symbols for us. We had to polemicize against Christians, right? Let me tell you something. In the year 1100, your Shabbos experience in France and Germany was to listen for 1 hour to your local priest explaining why Judaism is wrong and Christianity is right. And you couldn't go to Kiddush Club during that speech. They had said, fill the seats with people. Usually the person doing that was a former Jew who converted to Christianity, and he would spend a full hour on Shabbos morning speaking against Avram, against Yitzchak, against Yaakov, speaking against everything Jewish, speaking against the Torah, and explaining what glory is waiting for you if only you embrace the religion I found and correct the mistake that I was born into. Crazy stuff. So when you're writing commentaries in the midst of such a background, you tend to try to, you double back and you explain all these things in as positive light as possible. Okay? So it's important to have a background. Right? That being said, there are some commentaries who say, I don't give a hoot what's going on around me. This is what I think the text is saying. And they have a more, sort of more realistic approach to what the Bible says. So to answer my last question, why do the Jews living amongst Sephardim have a more realistic approach? Because the Muslims are not arguing with them about biblical text. They don't have to justify anything to them. Right? Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov are they're sacred people to Muslims too, but they don't have anything to say about them. They don't revere our text. We're not about to argue with them about what's written in the Quran. But Christians do revere the book of Genesis. And they're reading it all the time. So they're arguing with us, and so Jews living amongst Christians are more likely, in general, argues David Berger, to be more justifying in their kind of parish. All right? Okay, clear? Any questions on this? Okay. Okay, so what we're going to do, and then to start introducing to the... I have the pamphlet here it's called Morality of Biblical Characters, and it starts with Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Okay, so the Talmud says, you're making a mistake, that's not what he did. So we have to ask a question. If that's not what he did, why would the Torah malign him and say he did something so much worse than what you claim he did? So now, this is a very important element of our course that I'm about to tell you. Is that when we see these words in the Torah, we have a lot of things we want to do with it. We want to explain it, we want to present it. You know, it's voracious, it's maybe these are young kids reading this. You know what, the rabbis are teaching a very profound moral point here. They were not so much interested in what Reuven actually did that unfortunate day, but his motivation. Right? If you put tie me to this chair and say, I'm not going to let you free until you tell me what you think Reuven actually did that day, right? I'll tell you what I think doesn't matter, but I will tell you there are plenty of commentaries, starting with B'chor Shor and others, from the Bali HaTosfos, who say he did what the Pasuk says he did. Then, according to the B'chor Shor, the question reverts to the Gemara. Then, what are you talking? Why are you saying this? If he slept with her, why are you saying that he just moved the couch from one place to another? Because the Gemara is trying to tell us Reuven's motivation. What was it? What motivated him to do this? Was it just that he felt he was uncontrollably desirous of his father's concubine? She called his wife in some silly way. Right? I digress. Have you ever learned of a book called The Testament of the 12 Tribes? Tzavos HaShvatim. Have you heard of the pseudepigrapha? Apocrypha? No? Right, so these are Jewish books written after what we consider the close of the Tanakh. Christian Bibles include them as part of their holy Bible. They call it the Old Testament.
It's the Maccabees.
Maccabees is amongst them, right? It's called Jubilees. I suppose some of these books. The Book of Judith. The story of Yehudis, that we talk about Hanukkah, the Book of Tobit, the Book of Enoch, and Hanukkah. Right? These are books written from a Jewish standpoint. No doubt that there's nothing, no one is already involved. But they're just not considered canonized because it's past the time frame of the Tanakh, and it's not written with prophecy according to our understanding. Right? The Christians saw them as canonical, and you'll find Christian Bibles that contain these books. Right? One of these books is called The Testament of the 12 Tribes. It's a fascinating book. In the least, I would argue that you can quote it as a medrash. Right? What is it? Because in Midrashim like this, it talks about what each one of Yaakov's 12 sons told their own children on their deathbed. Interesting. It's like, you know what God told his children on his deathbed. Most of them are talking about Mechiras Yosef. Some of them are very interesting things you never heard from Midrashim. So what do you think Reuven is telling his children and his grandchildren, his great-grandchildren around his deathbed? The main focus of what he's telling them. What did I do with the girl? And by the way, it appears also in the Book of Jubilees. Two different places in the Apocrypha. It talks about what Reuven is telling his family around his deathbed, what he did with Bill. And now this is why I think that they don't have anything. Besides the time frame, besides the fact that it's not prophetic, any one of these reasons is enough to get you out of the Tanakh. But I don't see the moral. I don't see the moral here. In both of these stories, Reuven tells his children, stay away from strong drink. Wine will destroy you. Let me tell you why. Because I was once drunk. Well, another story, he wasn't the one that was drunk. Bilhah was the one that was drunk. And my father was away on some kind of trip, and she was alone, and she rendered herself unclothed. And I saw her, and I couldn't help my desire for her, and I had to have her at that moment. Right? And in both stories, amazingly, to figure out why, she's sleeping. She didn't even know he took her. Why does the Book of Jubilees and why does the Apocrypha insist that Bilbo did what it says he did? Because the Apocrypha doesn't mess around like that. It says it happened. That's the agenda, is just to tell the story. The Apocrypha, however, is busy telling you. It sees his motivation, but there's no moral in his motivation, like we're about to see in the Gemara.
his moral is that he just was drunk and out of his mind and he didn't realize what he was doing, or she didn't realize what she was getting into. You see, because when Yaakov finds out what happened, what Reuven did, he says he listened and he kept it in his heart. He didn't do anything right away. He only had the blessings on his own deathbed. He says, Reuven, you ruined my couch. You profaned my couch, and I'm getting even with you now. I'm taking away your birthright. You are pachas kamayim. You always have good intentions, but you never come through. Why didn't you, if you had saved Yosef that day? Of course, history would have been different. It was part of God's plan. But you always have good intentions. When you told me, I'll bring Binyamin home where you can kill my two children. What's the matter with you? You really think that would console me if I lost two sons? At least now I get to kill two grandsons? You always have good intentions, but you never come through. What the Gemara is about to say fits this scheme. The Apocrypha leaves me thirsty. It leaves me lacking. It leaves me wanting. The Apocrypha says that he saw her, he was consumed with desire for her, and he's teaching his children not to fall into the same trap. Ho-hum, I'm bored with that. Big deal. I know from Sefer Mishlei what can happen to you if you get too drunk. That leaves me so sober, so lacking. Right? I'll tell you what it does answer for me. Why, when Yaakov realized what happened, he says something in the Tanakh about Reuven, but he never says anything about Bilhah. Did Bilhah go kicking and screaming? Did she go willingly to a much younger man than her husband? Reuven, by all accounts, is much, much younger than Yaakov. 60, 70 years, 80 years younger than Yaakov. Right? I'm sure any woman who has ever lived would rather be with man 70 years younger than man 70 years older. Did Bilhah go willingly? So at least that the Apocrypha answers for me. Answer? No, because sleeping. Right? It's telling me things that, you know, if you're going to object what the Gemara is about to say, then you should object to the Apocrypha. How did the Apocrypha know she was sleeping? Well, the answer they'll say is because it doesn't say anything. It doesn't get angry with her. Alright? Okay. What is Reuven's motivation according to the Gemara? Why does he take Yaakov's couch from Bilhah's room and put it into his mother's room? He just gave it away. Once you know what he did. Right? When Rachel died, the very next pasuk says, Reuven slept with Bilhah, Rachel's hand. Right? So, this is what the Gemara says. Reuven is living through his whole life watching his mother play second fiddle to another wife. My mother was married first. I'm her firstborn. But I get it. I understand it. Rachel was the one that my father wanted. Right? Gemara says, and I don't know, it's a medrash that says that Yaakov wanted to divorce her the next morning when he saw who it was. But she says, listen, we were intimate last night. I may be carrying your child. Wait to see if I'm pregnant. Don't make me raise your child alone. If I'm not with child, I'm not with your child, if somebody did to me again until she could tell, then I'll go my own way. I realize now this is a bad idea. But if I'm with your child, let's make a go of this. Reuven was already conceived. Reuven raised his own. Chazal say that he was conceived that night. So he stayed with her and raised her family with her and created half a nation with her. Right? But Rachel was always his favorite. And that was very hard for Reuven to see, his mother not being respected the way he thought she should be. So when Rachel, my mother's maid Sarah, passes away, right, what should my father be doing? Moving in with my mother. Right? And instead, what does he do? He moves in with Bilhah. I will not see my mother play second fiddle to a handmaid. So what does he do? Come on, guys, wake up. So he moves the couch. He wants to say, no, you're not putting your couch in Bilhah's room. You're putting your couch in my mother's room. The Gemara says that that's such a trespass. How dare you tell your father what he should be doing like that? That's tantamount to violating the woman. Right? But, do you see the motivation? What's the motivation according to Chazal, whatever Rubin did?
Respect for his mother.
Respect my mother. Now, you can do that in a number of ways. Just be with tongue in cheek. Tell me, how can, because Leah will not play second fiddle to Zilpah, for goodness sakes. That's certainly not. Zilpah is Leah's own hand. But Bilhah is not, has nothing to do with Leah. So if Yaakov prefers to be with Bilhah, all right, Leah, I'm sorry, you're out of control. So what can Reuven do to fix that situation? Say anything you want. Good, be as outrageous as you want.
Talk to his father about
how... Okay, what else can he do?
That here.
He can kill Bilhah. Yeah, he could do it. Right? What else does he choose to do? If he sleeps with Bilhah, right? He may have enjoyed it, I don't know. But he's saying, no, that's not my intention. I'm sleeping with Bilhah not because I'm drunk and consumed with desire for her while my father's away. No. What's my purpose in sleeping with her? I'm being a tzaddik. No?
Trying to legitimize their marriage.
Yes. Yaakov will never sleep with her again if his son slept with her. Better than killing her. Right? You see, I'm not loving this picture we're painting of Reuven. But Chazal said, you know what? I don't care what Vayishkavetz Gala means. I don't care what he did that day. What he actually did in action. I care much more about why he did it. Whatever he did, let the third graders who learned Parshas Vayishlach just read that he moved to couch and all this. Right? What he actually did, I'll let the commentaries sort that out. You get it? If you tie me to the chair and you say, what do you think he did? I'll say, look, the Pasha Pshat is there. What can I say?
Right. It's interesting that Hazal's only concern with the intention of Yaakov's whole rebuke to Reuben was that his only intention.
He says, Oz Kivalti Tzubiola. He says, he doesn't mention any. He says, you should have said, Oz Shachafti Mishni. How about that? He just says, you profaned my couch. Very poetic way of saying something. Oh yeah, he just profaned the couch. He didn't profane the wife.
That's for sure. He didn't do that. I hope he'll know that that is not saying something right away.
So, what's interesting is that what we're going to learn in this course, not just the hard facts. We'll see that the Apocrypha approaches this a very different direction than Chazal. Chazal's agenda is different. It's more morality. What's the morality? What is behind his intention? Behind the action. The point that is, the action isn't even so important, what he actually did. His intention was to fortify his mother's honor. My mother has been disrespected for 20 years now, with another, 14 years with another wife, and now I'll do anything I can to make sure that she does not continue to be disrespected to Bill. Okay? Right, so that's with Reuven. Okay, but the alien B'nai Shmuel, I'll tell you that, these are considered bad guys in the Bible, right? Especially B'nai. So in these two instances, Rashi and his commentaries say that these two cases, they did just what's written about them. It's pretty amazing. Just what's written about them. They went after bribes, and they slept with women. He says, Kipshuta, Kimashma'o. He says, it did what it says. Right? So Rashi here agrees with the Gemara and Reuven, and here the stakes aren't so high in these guys. Right? But the way they treat the Na'ili is the same way the rabbis treat Reuven, is that, no, you
what he did isn't exactly what the Pashuk Pshat says. Their intention was something else. Right? Now with David is a little more complicated because the woman is pregnant there. You can't say that David didn't really see the Pashuk. Right? That's a little more complicated for us. Okay? She tells him she's pregnant, see? So instead of saying he didn't really sleep with her like they say with Reuben and Ben Haley, right? Instead they say he did sleep with her. She's pregnant. But the circumstances were different. You don't realize she wasn't really a married woman at the time. Okay? Okay, so let's read just a few lines from this Tshuva of the Chachmei Provence. You see there's an arrow with a line. Go to the very top of that line and go all the way down to the right. And it says Vidda. See that? Sorry, this is the best copy I could get for this. Okay, this is a 12th century collection of Tshuvas from Germany and France. But in Provence is... the borders changed very often then, over ages, between France and England and different places in Germany, in the Rhineland. So, Bedav Emes, Shekol Gizar Dino, Shel Shaul Nidchatem, Shalom Nimshecho Malchuto. We see that Shaul's kingdom lasted a pittance, just two meager years, such a short time. Right? Shalom nimshecho malchuto, va'avono hayo nichtam v'nikra. I'm sorry. V'nikra gizardino shel David. The lower level kafmos nahim. It says that Shaul's relatively small sins were enhanced to make him lose his kingdom, but David's much greater sins did not enter the scale like Shaul's smaller sins. What b'chiyish masupanim b'davar? Why is God playing such favorites with Shaul? I'm sorry, with David over Shaul. It's not fair. You don't know what I'm talking about in the narratives of Sefer Shmuel. Okay, so he answers the following: Ve'af al pi shegadol chet'o b'inyan Batsheva kiflei kiflayim. Even though David's sin with Batsheva is many, many more times worse than Shaul's sin. What was Shaul's great sin? He saved the Amaleki king. He took some of the sheep. He didn't wait the full 7 days for Shmuel in the beginning of Perek Gimel. And he called a witch to ask him as advice at the end of Shmuel. Now, of course, killing off all those Kohanim was pretty serious, but that was very serious.
Okay.
Right. Under Shaul's command, though, so. Yeah, Doeg who actually committed the murders. Okay, so he's saying, what is it that makes Shaul lose the kingdom more than David? Alright, so let's read the next line is why I'm giving you this. It says, V'afal pi, I know it didn't come out so good in the copy, but V'afal pi sherabotenu zichronam livracha, quotes the Gemara Shabbos in Sechazvah Zara, Ksuvus, Afal pi, Sherabotenu zichronam livracha havchu lizchut mishpato. Even though the rabbis switched it around to show that he was justified in what he did with Batsheva, schorom harbeh. Their reward should be great for trying to absolve David so much of sin. That's a cute way of saying this. Their reward should be great. I just have to say something that's so funny. There is a Gemara in Baba Basra at the end of the first perek where an Amora explains something about the Satan Bekavzchus. Right? The Satan did something that on the face of it looks terrible at the beginning of Sefer Iyov. But there's a rabbi in the Gemara that says, oh no, that the Satan only did that to be Bekavzchus for Abraham. He didn't do something terrible to Iyov. So the Gemara says that the Satan came down to earth and gave the rabbi a kiss in the head and he lived to be over 100. In other words, usually the Satan kisses you and you die. The Satan, Malach Mavis, right there says. But in this case, the satan, even the satan likes people to say good things about him. Maybe you've heard of sympathy for the devil, right? So everybody likes to be in a good light. So yeah, he gets good schar. David is going to come back from Shemayim and give you a good kiss if you explain him this so well. However, but the pshat is the pshat. I'm sorry. So why was David forgiven for kifle kiflay and much worse sins? Shaul is forgiven. The answer. So he just says that Shaul kept on passing over his guilt. He kept on complaining and saying, "No, I did what God wanted. Only after being told 3 or 4 times that you really didn't do what God wanted, then he finally wakes up and says, oh, I'll see how it's ended." Right? So that's the difference. You sin a great sin, you'll be forgiven if you do tshuva. But a small sin becomes worse than a great sin. If you keep making excuses. I think I have a better... The Pravanel, I think, gives a better explanation. He says that David's sins... are sins of passion. Might not have sinned that way if he had not been king. But Shaul's sins are chisronos in a melech. A king cannot blame taking the sheep that he wanted. And he says, Asher Chomal Ha'am. A king cannot blame his excesses or his sins on the people. I'm sorry, he just can't do that. It's not a kingly thing to do. Right? So that's why he's punished. So you see that these Chachmei Provence, they're very familiar with all the Gemaras and Shas that read David in a very negative light and all, you know, I'm sorry, in a positive light about everything, but they still want to be realistic about what David did that day. So this is going to be the first part of our semester, sort of a tension between those who want to read the Pshat as it appears and those who will go to a different kind of agenda, as we saw by Reuven, and we'll come to draw some clear conclusions about the way Chazal treat and all that. All right, so.